Hello, everybody, and welcome. This is Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice, and I'm Terry Patton. I created and I host this series, and for anyone there who doesn't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author of Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber. I created this series in order to push the envelope a little bit at the edge of the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating an ongoing and deep public dialogue about how growth in consciousness, higher consciousness, and spiritual practice can actually enable human beings to rise to meet our current crises and challenges and actually make a benign transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet. So this program is a part of a whole series of remarkable conversations that have probed this question with many of today's leading thought leaders and spiritual teachers. And you can access this by registering at beyondawakeningseries.com. This morning, I'm really happy to be joined by Helen Palmer, and we're going to be deepening that discussion in a conversation we're titling Waking Up from the Partial Truths That Bind Us. Now, the way this will work is I'll introduce Helen, and then we'll spend about an hour having a real living exploration of this topic. Then I'll make some announcements, and then we'll spend about half an hour taking your questions, so we'll finish up in about 90 minutes, or perhaps just a little more than that. Helen Palmer is an internationally known best-selling author and teacher of the interface between psychology and spiritual states. Her primary focus lies with a vastly underused faculty of intuitive perception, commonly called the inner observer. This often overlooked reflective capacity of mind develops by observing the structural patterns that drive each type of human being in a predictable direction. We have a natural inbuilt ability to observe the structure of our subjective reality and report our patterns that repeat to others. This inward turn of attention enables us to voluntarily relax the conditioned patterns that we otherwise cling to, patterns that repeat an adaptive childhood survival strategy. Our direct participation in relaxing conditioned neural pathways that inhibit objective perceptions of reality as it is, this marks a growth into a new stage of consciousness. So Helen has presented this inner observer perspective on higher states of consciousness at Harvard, Loyola University, Esalen Institute, JFK University here in the Bay Area, and also the California Institute of Integral Studies. Back in 1988, 25 years ago, together with psychiatrist David Daniels, she co-founded Enneagram Studies in the Narrative Tradition, which is really the largest worldwide teaching network that reaches many thousands of people in many countries. She presents the Enneagram from the inside out through seminars, workshops, and online courses. Her books on the Enneagram, she has five of them, including really the classic text, the Enneagram itself, and they're translated into 28 languages. And they're also subject to the PBS documentary, Breaking Out of the Box. What I especially appreciate about Helen is that in addition to being one of the original and foremost experts on the Enneagram in the world, she has enormous psychic gifts and capacities, which she brings to everything she does. She possesses a penetrating, almost X-ray vision, which enables her to see into how the unique fixations and perturbations of free-flowing consciousness express themselves in individuals, and how the patterns of those fixations can be understood, especially using the map of the Enneagram. She's also an uncommon guide to actual experiential processes that liberate awareness and evolve consciousness. So, welcome, Helen. I'm really delighted to have you with me today. Oh, we're not hearing you. Let's see what we can do about that. Aha, now you're coming through. Welcome.
Well, thank you for the very gracious introduction. It certainly seems like a lot of years spent, and I'm pleased to have someone keeping track.
Well, great. You know, in this introduction, I think what I've said has spoken a little bit from the outside. It might be interesting just to begin by telling us all, maybe from the inside, about what drives you, what you care most passionately about, and from that perspective, something about what's at the essence of your work.
Well, the perspective is still unfolding and was always surprising. It's always been surprising what the next stage brings. I was in a graduate program in Manhattan and already had one son when I started to have a series of experiences. It's not an uncommon story among people who have these openings. But I didn't know where to put it because at that time, in the early 60s, there was very little about meditation practice. Suzuki Roshi had yet to materialize his teachings on the West Coast. It was an absence that went unnoticed of the inner life and its various capacities. So to make a long story short, I had a spiritual opening always around the axis of intuition, inner knowing, about which there was practically nothing in the psychological literature, which is not so far off the mark still today. Not much on the actual mechanics and capacities, the breadth of vision that intuition brings. So, again, I followed the wave of interest to the West Coast in the late 60s. I was active as a resistor of the Vietnam War, and it got very hot for us in Manhattan, so my family and I came out here to the West Coast, where it was a lot more hospitable to New Thought ideas, both political and spiritual. And my experiences, which had been sporadic, became quite flagrant, particularly dream life, lots of precognition, none of which was alarming or frightening to me. It just seemed like a natural course of events. None of this interior development has seemed alarming. Although when I try to speak about it, it sounds like someone making claims about paranormal capacities. And there's some truth in that. My openings were always about future events. And because of the presentation in my dreams, I naturally assumed that all of this was about inner visualization. So I sought out a hypnotherapist at that time, which was about all that was available to me. And I had a very good experience of dropping into a state of mind that was entirely present-centered. And like a dream, the sequence of interior visions would present themselves before I knew what was going to show up. So unlike hypnotism, which has a focus on doing something, you know, like stage fright or teaching fright, something like that, where there was an agenda. This had no agenda. I simply would focus my attention and drop into an interior state and go through the processes of auto-suggestion, which is elevators, escalators, that kind of thing. And I would arrive in a room that was private and wonderful for me, and sit in a chair and wait. And sure enough, the visions continued in this waiting stage because I was fairly stabilized in the present moment. And that was there from the beginning. My concentration capacity is very strong, and I can place my attention and remain in one place in an internal state for quite a long time. So I didn't learn that. It seemed to come with the package of this lifetime. So the present-centeredness was there, which is now being taught in spiritual practice on a worldwide basis from every conceivable direction, the importance of being able to stay in the present moment through breath observation, through visualization, through mantra, through whatever form you follow. The abiding in now, the present moment extended into a state of mind that essentially stops the passage of time, gets you into a state where the past and the future can be known. And that was my my understanding. I had very good help from a Rosicrucian fellow. They have still a very nice body of visualization practices, and I took that on for a while. And in a very short time, this became a stable part of my life. I did sessions on an international basis, starting in my living room, and it spread word of mouth for years. Thousands of readings for people, and that was a job for me. That was a calling. And eventually, I started to teach what I knew from observing, being able to observe the placements of attention in my own mind that was suitable to other people, what they could follow and what they could do through concentration. Now, the strength of that is that concentrative practice gives you these these abilities. There's not much objection to that in the literature. But it doesn't relax the structures in yourself that create suffering, psychological conditioned structures that create human suffering. And I noticed this in my clients, my students, and also in myself, that it seemed like two operating lives, one here, and suffering attached to that according to my type, and then the freedom of being in a vertical axis of consciousness where there was no suffering. And that really rang a bell to me because, you know, this is way before the days of looking at spiritual bypass and those kinds of matters, where essentially you have two different aspects of brain, each, you know, independently operative from the other. Mm. And there's not much work in crossing these two aspects of self. So that became a calling. And around the same time in the early 70s, I got word of, I was teaching intuition training at Esalen, and had begun talks at John F. Kennedy University, which had a school of consciousness attached to it, the first in the country, actually. And between those avenues of being able to teach, the separation of psychological type from the capacities which actually the type inhibited, the spiritual capacities which were inhibited by the type. So I got interested in that topic, and that's where the Enneagram came into the picture. There was a training given by a South American Madge, Oscar Echazo. Word came to Esalen, 40 or so of Esalen people, including several of my own students, went to Chile to study with him. He was using the diagram that was known to us through the Gurdjieff work, and the presentation at Esalen was that this was an update of the Gurdjieff material. So the material came back, the diagram, plus a few rather rough notes, which was all that we had, came back to Esalen, came back to me that way, and I immediately saw the centerpiece of the psychological resistances to spiritual states, which are embedded in the Enneagram system. So long story short, the crossover between, I hate to use the word psychism because it has so much baggage, but it is a spiritual capacity of knowing, inner knowing.
Mm-hmm.
The crossover between that aspect of brain and the brain that thinks and is conditioned in a cognitive emotional habit And that's been my work for many years now.
Beautiful. That's a wonderful introduction to get us really tuned
into you. It's a
little dense,
don't you think?
Well, you're trying to speak with a lot of precision about.
Well, I have to do that. I often get the comment, you know, like, you don't look like you talk.
Well, I think there's a kind of fierce seriousness in you about, you know, accurately getting below what tends to be a slushy or unconscious level of discussion to really focus on something more substantive. And that's how I interpret that intensity and specificity, which you might call dense. I think it's great.
Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, with that clarified, then please link us up to the core question that I articulated in the introduction. How can this understanding of fixations, this capacity to awaken the inner observer, really make a difference and help human beings, not just individually, but together, to rise and meet this particular and very poignant moment of transition and crisis and transformation?
Well, the first move, the Buddha said, and it's an eternal truth, is to start working with your own suffering. I'm a trained psychologist, and that point of relaxing personal suffering is the keystone of all of the investigations of various therapies. And it's a very precious agenda. The work of turning inward, turning attention inward in order to reflect upon or observe the internal patterns that drive you is actually a spiritual action. The first turning of attention to witness the structure of your own character type is a huge undertaking, and altogether taken for granted. Most people can turn attention inward, though I have seen a few that cannot. They simply turn inward, and the big question is, well, what am I supposed to be seeing? You know, what I don't understand the direction. That kind of I've seen it, but it's not common. Most people can turn inward and give a credible representation of their own internal processes without even considering that this might be a leap in consciousness. Yet it is, because there is an aspect of brain that can witness independently of thought, independently of emotion, that can witness the structure of your own personality type as it takes place. And that this should not be noted in the psychological literature and underlined a great deal is mysterious. But the fact is that by turning attention inward, you can verify not the individual thoughts. We're not interested in the personal story. We're not interested in the recreated personal story of your past, your future, and we know that that story changes constantly over time. It's not a stable structure. So the personal story isn't what you're looking for. And then it gets a little bit more of a load on the self-observational capacity, which is you're looking for the way your brain sorts information, the way that your brain is conditioned to perceive reality creates a very swift sorting of information, so that out of billions of bits of data that are supplied to the senses on a moment-by-moment basis, the brain, in its sophistication, sorts all of these items out so that you can make sense of things. And what you're looking for in the Enneagram is just what a psychologist would be urging their client to discover. Turn inward and tell me about not what you think, but the pattern of the way that your mind works. And this is at the root of psychological diagnosis. You have a paranoid type, an obsessive type, a compulsive type, because the client or histrionic type, all kinds of types, 9 of them. And you have these, the psychologist can recognize the type of person you are by your revealing the way that your mind operates, not the individual story of your past, your future, etc. So the way my mind works as an Enneagram 6 on the Enneagram is that without realizing it, all automatically patterned, my mind goes to a series of questions, doubt. It's called the monk of doubting mind, where a series of questions seems to be posed. Well, do they have the right information? What about the other side of this question? What else have I heard on this topic? Where does this fit in the scheme of my prior understanding? See, my mind is busy with questioning statements, questioning people. I don't know this, of course, but with observation and turning inward and slowing down the whole brain mechanism, of course a clinician can recognize the difference between a paranoid thinker, myself, and an obsessive-compulsive thinker, which has a whole different process of sorting information. So that's what the type cognition is about. It's a pattern that's conditioned in childhood to keep you safe, from my perspective, in a dangerous world. From an obsessive nine's perspective, it would be a world that has very many mixed messages and other people involved, and you have to pay attention to everybody else's opinion, and you have to know where they stand before you stand. And so the whole brain mechanism is preoccupied with others in the sense of their priorities sound louder than one's own. Now, that is not my problem set. My problem set is this a safe or secure situation or is it not? So these are childhood questions, and there are 9 of these different profiles, and they have a very strong history, background, all of that in psychological diagnosis, assessment, and treatment. The Enneagram is a normal and high-functioning version of the pathologies described in the psychological literature. This isn't about pathology. It's just about getting around in life and leading an ordinary life. Relatively easy for most people to turn attention inward and observe the pattern of their thoughts and tell them to somebody else. The more difficult inward turn is to discover by self-observation the emotional habit that is driving those patterns. And that is actually the signature of the Enneagram type. And when I first got it, you know, it was pretty obvious. It was the emotional patterns were 9 in number, and 7 of them were the Christianity's 7 deadly sins. So it didn't take much thought to be able to recognize this as a spiritual system that had somehow come down through, you know, thousands of years to us, because the system has a much longer history than just Christianity with its 2,000-some years of existence. But this was a spiritual system, and I was teaching intuition, which is a spiritual activity, and I also had a history in psychology. I taught psychology for a number of years. So those two axes in myself, the psychological that suffered and the spiritual that did not and had access to a wide range of information, seemed to come together in this 9-pointed star with the peculiar gap in the bottom of the diagram, came together as this may be a map that will help my students to recognize their psychological suffering and relax it by means of spiritual method. That was my thought.
So that, in a way, this is really right about, this is focusing right on the intersection between the psychological and the spiritual,
yes.
the fulcrum itself, perhaps.
The fulcrum itself is exactly what I focus on. You know, I had a room full of students, and as soon as they would start to focus on the placements of attention that would access intuition, you know, what came up was a boatload of suffering, you know, about their children, their families, their history, their job, their boss, all of that stuff. And it did not seem to them that this had any relevance to their ability to concentrate, except as soon as they concentrated, the suffering came up. It barred the way to being able to place your attention cleanly in a trajectory that opens intuition. So I took it very seriously. Some of my most talented students had this split. And when they began to actually realize that they had intuitive capacity and that it could be trained, they, you know, just freaked out. They freaked out because the suffering patterns of their life, the conditioned cognitive emotional habit, which is organized to keep this suffering out of the conscious mind, was laid bare. The practices of spirituality open up the barriers to this suppressed material that people have neatly contained, all unknowing, all not knowing what they're holding back. What comes up is the uncooked cognitive emotional habits.
And this suggests to me that you might be able to make some kind of large-scale comments that might be very useful to a lot of the folks listening to us right now about how this fundamental growth in consciousness, in our ability to be present, in our ability to simply be awake as the witnessing consciousness, how that opens space both for our psychological self-understanding and our coming into a healthy relationship with the patterns that we tend to otherwise be embedded in, and how that opens up space for our spiritual growth, and how the spiritual might be different from, complementary to, interacting with the psychological. I'd love to hear you extrapolate.
Well, the conversation just went up a notch, and I hope I can come through for you. When attention turns in to witness the structure of your own typology, you come up with the pattern of thought, we've discussed that, and the emotional habit that drives that thought. The emotional habit is generally masked. It only comes up serving a protective function when outer conditions seem to trigger us. So if you're a monk of fearful mind, if there's danger out there, you get triggered internally. If you're an obsessive monk, the nine on the Enneagram, if there are too many options and too many people holding conflicting points of view, you get very triggered inside. The triggering means that you have a direct experience of, in the case of the monk of obsessive mind, anger, a primary instinctual emotion, and in my case, anxiety, a primary paranoid emotion. So we have instincts that get exposed, and those are coming out of the reptilian brain. We develop a structure, a psychological structure, to contain all of this. And it's a wonderful study. The Enneagram is probably the best map in the universe about the different patterns of defensive structure, psychological structure. And that gets triggered as soon as you start holding your attention in the present moment, because the present moment is unknown. And when the present moment extends in time and you start to absorb into the vertical ascent, you are unprotected by those sectors of brain that have all of these processes that come into play whenever you have to face the unknown. So just being present for any extended period of time brings these psychological issues to the foreground. Now, many people can use these two sections of brain, the receptive intuitive section and the conditioned structures of psychological life. You can use them independently. And we know this from the current MRI scans, which are only maybe 15 years old in their precision. And we can you can put a neural net on a experienced meditator, and yes, they think and feel, and there's a lot of blood flow and neurological activity moving into those sectors of brain. That would be the forebrain and the limbic brain, the midbrain, limbic, emotional center. So those two centers are firing away with lots of activity and blood flow while thinking and emotional life are taking place. But at will, by bringing attention in and relaxing into the breath, which is always in the present moment, that same individual can voluntarily shift from cognitive emotional life to an interior life that is quiet, peaceful, and has all kinds of health benefits attached to it. So I'm speaking of primarily of the work of Jon Kabat-Zinn and people who have documented mindfulness-based stress reduction and all of the wonderful literature that surrounds that material that has become public in the last 10 years. All of that documentation has done, you know, people like myself who are interested in these interfaces between different states of consciousness, it's given us a lot to work with, and I'm very grateful for that.
Yes, yes. It's been a big theme in past interviews with people like Rick Hansen and Dan Siegel on this series.
Well, you know, I know Dan. I don't know Rick Hansen, but the it's the documentation of the different sectors of brain and their function, put into layman's language, has been the best thing that ever happened to people like myself. Because in an orderly way, it gives credence to the voluntary shift between states of consciousness. But my focus is on what is the structure that is separating these two states of mind. And the structure is myself. What stands between yourself and a received spiritual experience, which is unconditioned states of unconditioned areas of brain. Dan described it as like a field of new snow. When you meditate, you're building tracks in the section of brain that you go to when you begin to be present-centered and can extend time in the present moment. You're building new tracks, and you get used to those tracks. So you can meditate more deeply, the more that you apply yourself to shifting attention to a receptive present state of mind. So those are neurological tracks. They're new, but they do have a location in brain, and they can be embedded and deeply grooved through repetition. Now, all of that said, the interface, when you turn attention inward, you don't see those tracks. You don't see your brain. What you do see are the structures that inhibit deeper access to present time awareness. That's the pattern of thinking. That's the pattern of emotion. That's essentially the categories of mind that are detailed in a very simple Buddhist map, which is, if you bring your attention inward and you focus your attention on your thoughts, that's category one. And if you shift your attention to a memory in your own past, this is a different sector of brain called category two. And if you shift your attention from category two, a very real memory, you have to actually perform these shifts to get the benefit of the Buddhist map. If you shift to a future plan, category three, an actual plan that will happen in the future, but only one. because the brain is inherently single-pointed, and you can only do one category at a time. So the thought and the memory disappear as the plan begins to unfold. And if you dwell on the plan, if you focus on the actual events that might happen there, it becomes very real internally. And this is a different sector of brain. Now, if you focus on the imagination, a very large category, four, just focus on a pleasant place where you like to spend time. I generally go to the pleasant place where I used to meditate in my home and where my intuition became manageable to me. But go to a pleasant place. The important thing is that you don't go from place to place to place. You go to one place and place your attention there. Now, are you alone or with other people? Are you indoors or outside? Where exactly are you inside yourself? And could you describe it to somebody else? And of course you could. You could tell them what was in this pleasant place, if you're in or outdoors. You could tell them many things. So you apply attention to the focal object where you have placed your attention. In answer to the question, where am I? Are you alone or with other people? What are you wearing? Are you seeing yourself from behind yourself, or are you inside of yourself looking out through your eyes? Can you have your emotions in the pleasant place? Just imagine you are feeling what you would feel if you were really there. Emotion comes in. Category 5, emotion. And category 6, can you stand and walk in the pleasant place and feel your feet on the floor and your body moving from one foot to the other? Just walk around the place. Can you feel the temperature on your face and hands? Can you look down and see your shoes? And all of this takes place in present time awareness instead of moving from thing to thing, as the type structure is organized to do. Now, just come out. And now I'd like to talk about that simple Buddhist map. The categories are highly conditioned, they're very familiar, and they limit perception to the cognitive emotional level of consciousness. But the fact that you are moving your attention into the present moment takes you out of the ordinary level of consciousness and into another place. And the structures of thought, emotion, and sensation relax when you're in the present moment. The emptying practice that does not use internal imagination at all, which is the practice of mindfulness, also called the way of negation in the Christian sector and by different names in different societies. The mindfulness practice is another strategy, if you want to call it that, a strategy for keeping attention in the present moment and away from the conditioned categories. A spiritual experience occurs when, whether you're using visualization or emptiness, breath observation practice, visualization and other forms of imagination are called the affirmative way in the Christian sector, concentration practice. Emptying practice, the way of negation, uses breath or returning attention again and again to one single object of devotional meaning, like centering prayer. So all of that said, your psychological processes, thoughts, emotions, sensations, recede. They recede all the time. We just don't think that's important. I mean, where is the thought you had 5 minutes ago? It's not there anymore. Or the thought you'll have 5 minutes from now hasn't occurred yet. So we know these are temporary categories, thoughts, feelings, sensations, and that they recede as a matter of natural course of action. We don't have to make them go away. They just do when they're not useful. And then they come back again when they are. But the deliberate recession of the categories was my first focus of attention. Because most people can do this. They can allow voluntarily, they can cooperate voluntarily with relaxing the categories of ordinary consciousness in favor of the unknown. We know that triggers psychological resistance. However, when it's done gently, in a relaxed way, and with a spiritual purpose, it's relatively easy for most people to get into the present moment and to remain there for some period of time. That's the shift point from conditioned consciousness to unknown, to unconditioned possible consciousness yet to come. So that's the structure that I'm interested in, that interface between the horizontal conditioned categorical mind and the ability to receive an impression before you know what's going to show up on the screen, which is the hallmark of a spiritual experience. It's always received. The type structure can't have a spiritual experience, but people have them all the time because they're received when you're in the right state of mind to take them in. So that's all I want to say about that.
Yeah, well, that was very, very rich. And what I, there are many different directions to go, but I probably should be faithful to the theme of the series and ask a question I've asked many people, which is, okay, I see that. That is the process of awakening and freeing myself and freeing my consciousness from my patterns, and gives me a capacity not to simply live from the embeddedness in the pattern in the same way. But this is something that takes real growth, and it's a slow process, like psychological and spiritual development has always been. Does this time of crisis, you know, 7 billion people, mass extinctions, global warming, which seems to call for something more rapid, is there a way to break the pattern of the past? You know, as James Hillman said, we've had 100 years of psychotherapy and the world is getting worse. There have been thousands and thousands of years of in which we've had the influence of great spiritual awakeners and transmitters, and there has been this understanding of higher states of consciousness, and they've been actually cultivated, that there's somewhat of a intensification of that now among a leading edge of culture in the most privileged countries in the world. But do you have a sense, can you imagine the ways that the mechanisms you've studied so deeply could catalyze something that could represent a more rapid shift to a freer kind of consciousness and behavior?
Indeed I do. And that enter the Enneagram. We had to start somewhere with this diagram that I knew described the interface between the seen and unseen worlds. I knew that. But as you say, this is not exactly user-friendly as an opening remark. But what is very user-friendly is that the Enneagram map is probably the best public education on the planet when it is focused on the ordinary matter of how people relate to themselves, especially how they interact with other people. And as a third option, voluntary option, would be the transformational process. Now, our conversation focused on the transformational first, and I never meant to neglect that. But the general public doesn't know anything about this level of consciousness alluded to by the Enneagram system. What they do know is it's probably the best map that they ever had to understand their children, their spouse, their partners, you know, their boss, their colleagues, other people. And you have to start with yourself, knowing your own type structure and being able to recognize by using the inner observer to recognize what type of person you are. That's not hard. There are, you know, thousands of people out there that learned it from a book in a bookstore. Performing what we would call a differential diagnosis, they would open up a book and say, well, here's nine types. I'm not that, not that, not that. Well, here's a couple that I might be. And, well, let me think about the differentiating issues between these two lookalikes. And, well, lo and behold, you come up with a type. Now, all of that has been done by the self-observation of oneself that you didn't even know you were doing. It was an unconscious activity to investigate, what am I feeling? What am I thinking right now? Why do I like this person? What are my thoughts about them? Who does it remind me of that I'm thinking about this person? That kind of simple inquiry is going on all the time and has paid off in being able to open a book that could be called a sacred text, an Enneagram book, but they don't know anything about that. They see bullet points and type charts, and they recognize themselves. And lo and behold, they might recognize other people in their life as well. Oh, this is my mom. Oh, this is my colleague. They act. It's not about behavior. They act that way, but I have a relationship with them, and I know a little about their motives as well, you know, why they do what they do. And so, you know, people aren't coming to Enneagram classes to learn about the transcendental shift to the vertical ascent. They're coming to find out from a panel of speakers that were good enough to come that evening, usually my students, and I will interview, or one of the other teachers, senior teachers, will interview. And the panel reveals the way they think, the way they feel, the way they interact, how they want to be treated, how they really dislike being treated. All of that comes piling out in very user-friendly language. And over these many years of developing panels and teaching from that panel method, the wonder, if you can get a set of panelists that shares the same demographic as the audience, it really speeds up the learning immensely. I remember teaching a bunch of unionists years ago. And, you know, they're men and women that belong to the union. They're on the stage, and I'm interviewing, and they're telling their story. And the hall was filled with people. I thought, God, I never knew Joe or Jane in quite that light before. Well, now I understand why they say that. Well, they have a motive, and their motive is logical, and this is where it came from. Well, now I understand, and I don't take it personally anymore when they trigger my resistance to things. It's not unconscious anymore when somebody tells you how their mind works and how they want to be treated and how you have to make a report, you know, and what they don't like about people, and where you have to be very careful that you're not offensive without realizing it. So the user-friendly education on a public level has been mesmerizing to me, and it's been the major activity of mine. We have a training center. These panels are going on all around the world in different languages. It's not that difficult a teaching method. They make wonderful videos of panelists who were, again, good enough to describe themselves in public. And nobody dies when these, you know, patterns are made clear about their intention and, you know, how differently nine different types of people see the world. So I think we've been very successful in teaching through this user-friendly method. What happens in the hall is, in answer to your question, Terry, there's a compassion that comes up for other people. And it may sound very small, but I think the most important revolution in consciousness happens at this grassroots level, where people understand the vast differences between themselves and others that they just didn't know about before. There's a huge, you know, uprising of compassion, like, wow, I never knew that that was who I was married to. I hear this, you know, on a daily basis. I never realized that my kids weren't all the same, but how vastly different they were. I just didn't realize that. I wasn't looking at this dimension of unseen patterning. And I trust them more because I understand how they work, and it's logical, and I try it out. You know, I try out resisting doing my automatic thing, and look, it has a wonderful effect. So in terms of transformation of consciousness, we started out at the high end. At the more modest, ordinary level, I think this is a transformative instrument that is, you know, given to us to understand the differences among us. The trust level builds hugely when you understand the predictability of how somebody else thinks about things. So, okay. On a modest level, I would see it as great public education.
Yeah. And that gives you a sense of hope that this actual process that we're engaging here right now, in this dialogue that you've been engaging in all your work for this last several decades, is building a much more rapidly progressing compassion and awareness and freedom that, although right now it doesn't already show itself in human behavior on the scale of what's necessary to meet our larger crises,
well,
really has
does.
That as a if potential.
It, yeah, it does have the potential, and I think that's more immediate than we may realize. I saw a wonderful YouTube. One of my students brought in a YouTube cut of Galinka, who's a Buddhist meditation teacher, and he's standing up at the UN with all of the faces. You can imagine what the UN Council Chamber looks like. There's a lot of different faces there. And he's simply saying, your negative emotions need to be relaxed so that you stop suffering. If you stop suffering, you will not create suffering for other people. And at least the younger members that I saw in the camera shots on the YouTube clip, the younger people in the hall, they stood up and cheered. It's about self-change, self-transformation, which changes your literal perception of reality as it's actually unfolding. The paranoid doesn't see a dangerous world anymore. The obsessive, the 9 on the Enneagram, doesn't see a world full of other people's agendas and they're left out. You just don't see it that way anymore. There's a perceptual shift in consciousness, perceptual, out there in the real world. When you change or relax into your resistance, it's all internal, in your internal world. So the process is pretty clear. Oh, here's a good example. The reconciliation process of Desmond Tutu. Do you know it?
The truth and reconciliation process that was enacted in South Africa?
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah,
huge.
That gets perpetrators and victims who came out of the same village. They have nowhere to repatriate the perpetrators who have done terrible things except back to the home village. There's no place for them to go. They could sit in jail the rest of their life, or they could be repatriated. So this film that I saw, I think it was a PBS film, of Desmond sitting in his long pink Archbishop of the Episcopalian faith robe,
right,
is sitting on a log, and they bring in some fair witnesses from a different village. Maybe 10 or 12 of them are sitting. The thing goes on for days, and the first speakers are the victims, you know, and there they are with their machete wounds, you know, an arm off or a great scar, and you know, they accuse the individuals who perpetrated these actions because they know them. And say, you did this to me, and you killed my husband right in front of me. And, you know, I want you dead. I want you to suffer as a result of this. You know, justice has to be served. And it starts out that way, and it doesn't look good. It's World War III in a microcosm. And the perpetrators, because of the promise of no retaliation, there will be no consequence whether you admit to the crime or don't. No consequence. That's the key. The no consequence meeting goes on for a day of the victims lining up and pointing at various people and saying, you did it, you did it. And many, many of the perpetrators said, yes, I did, but now listen to my side. I was 8 when they kidnapped me and threw me into a pit of violence. Why didn't you come to save me? Why didn't you help me? Now, from the adult perspective, it's like, could not. And from the child's perspective, it's would not, did not. So these kids are kidnapped, in the night and taken away. They're gone in the morning. And what are the parents to do except to stay in the village, which is all that they have? And then those very same kids, 5, 6, even 10 years later, come back and are forced into this atrocity and are steeled to commit those crimes because of the violence that they have endured themselves out in the wilds with a bunch of adults who are trying to bond them into a really good assassination crew. When those stories of what the kids went through, now grown and back there as perpetrators in the home village, when those crimes against the children are revealed, there's quite a silence. But you have to wait for the psychological issue of the victim to be told. And you have to wait for the psychological story of the perpetrator to be told. And there has to be an atmosphere of no consequence. The last shot on this, again, I think it's a PBS show, the last shot of it is of one of the victims who was most angry and most calling for revenge, walking down a little road to the only well in the village with a big bucket on her head. And here comes the perpetrator who committed the crime against her family and herself. And he's coming back from the well in the opposite direction, and they pass and they don't speak. And then the interviewer gets the woman, the victim, on screen and says, well, we saw that you didn't speak, so what are your feelings about that? And she said, well, I said a great deal, and so did he, and I have other things to do. I can't be bothered with this anymore. Do you see that stunning fusion of horizontal, ordinary living with verticality? Just in that statement, her whole affect had been relaxed away from the event, though the memory of the event remained intact. She just didn't have a reaction anymore. Now that is my hope for humanity. No reaction from the psychological type structure. That's my hope.
Beautiful. And what a vivid story.
Oh.
Ah.
Just the reconciliation method is the best thing I've ever seen. And it means that the affect must be heard, understood, and relaxed, the emotional reaction. And there must be an attitude of total permission. Whatever you say is fine. Whatever you do is fine. No retaliation. It's stunning, based on the polarization of the world as we know it.
Well, that is a beautiful note of hope on which to to transition. I just want to keep going in this, but we do have a point where we wanted to make some announcements.
Yes.
If you have questions for Helen or me, if you're listening by phone, please raise your hand by pressing *2 on your keypad, or if you're listening online by computer, please type it in the Instant Teleseminar window. And first, I'd like to make sure you know how to find out more about Helen's work. First, I want you to be aware of her books. She has authored or co-authored 5 prominent books on the Enneagram, including the classic text, The Enneagram, Understanding Yourself and Others in Your Life, The Essential Enneagram, The Enneagram in Love and Work, and more. And then on the web, for Helen's teaching schedules in the United States and around the world, you can go to enneagramworldwide.com. And she also teaches some distance learning programs, and you can find those on enneagram.com and then look her up. There are many teachers listed there, so look up Helen Palmer at enneagram.com. Is there anything else you'd like to make people aware of, Helen?
No, except that, with a little grace, I'll have a book on this interface between psychological patterning and spiritual experience.
Mm.
I think it'll be out in the beginning of 2014. So look for that. It's of another dimension, probably be my last work that I do. And I've waited a long time for another publication because the climate wasn't right. I think in answer to your question, how do we respond to the current emergency, a global emergency? The climate in a global emergency is ripe for radical change. And the radical change is no more than listen to my story and I'll listen to yours. And I know your story well because you spoke from an understanding of your patterns. And not just opinions, like political opinions, but from the level of your consciousness where you can tell me how you work inside so that I can treat you decently. And you're no threat to me because now I know who you were, how you work. So the consciousness is, it's both threatening and also very promising.
Mm. Mm. Thanks for returning to that. While we're talking about how people can experience you, I guess I do want to mention that you will be speaking, for those of us who are in the San Francisco Bay Area, at Bay Area Integral on May 29th. That's worth mentioning, too. Additionally, I want everyone here to be aware of my work. You probably have gotten emails with the news that my online course, Integral Spiritual Practice, has just recently been released for the first time digitally. You know, a rich and authentic daily practice is absolutely essential to real transformation and even to full human happiness, really quite a bit along the lines of what Helen has been talking about here. And yet, it's really hard for people to find their way into a truly transformative practice in today's world. It seems as though, often it seems as though we're kind of confronted with a choice between getting very involved in a particular focus that's almost cultic on one hand, or else hanging out in the marketplace and taking a cafeteria-style approach to personal growth in which the power of the sacred never really gets enough traction to truly, fully break us through into awakening. There's the famous traditional admonition, don't drill a lot of shallow holes. If you want to strike water, you have to drill one deep hole and keep at it. But it's paradoxical for people now because we need to and should pay attention to various kinds of psychological and emotional growth, spiritual practice, transformational relationships, intellectual, philosophical explorations, physical practices. So I've brought together in this course a tremendous range of wisdom in a way that I think can transform your relationship to practice so that you can wisely exercise your freedom to explore widely, but in a way that brings profound coherence and depth to that whole process. So in just 8 sessions, you'll go through a step-by-step process that takes you from being a seeker to being a real practitioner in a way that's truly uncommon. So by the time you finish this course, I think things will click into place in a remarkable way that has a kind of clarity that changes things forever. So you can find out more about it at terrypattencourse.com. Terrypattencourse.com. You can make one simple choice that will create many wide-ranging and wide-reaching changes in your life by simply deciding to register for it. And then finally, please stay on the line. At the end of this call, I'll tell you about upcoming guests on this program, including the next one, the renowned pioneer of the study of consciousness, Stanislav Grof. So let's see, what questions do we have? I think I want to turn first to someone who's raised their hand on the phone from Burlington, Vermont, 802 area code. We don't have
Thank
your name.
You.
Welcome. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, I will. My name is Sarah Grace, and wow, I am so glad to be here because I read your book, Helen, a million years ago. I've known for the last 20 years that I am the definite number 6. And my question is, you know, on and off I've done a lot of reading and exploring, but I want to know how I can heal those wounds and really make substantial changes in you know, how I interact with life, because I still live in a lot of fear, doubt, and insecurity.
Well, one way you could do it is to see the doubt as a signal. You need to be able to recognize when you start to go into your automatic habit of questioning. Instead of just taking a statement at face value, you go into a kind of internal thought process of questioning. So that's what doubt is. It'd be wonderful if you could recognize that as it starts to occur, particularly when you're alone and you start to doubt, you know, or a question a decision you have to make or a relationship that you have or something like that. And you realize, you know, this, you have to bring into your awareness, this is automatic. This is not constructive. So that's a marker.
Yeah. I mean, I am absolutely aware, but I get so stuck in that doubt because I feel immobilized.
The doubt is meant to immobilize you so you don't have to take action in a dangerous world. We know that. But what is driving the doubt is an emotion which presents itself as a contraction in your physical body. So as long as the doubt's in process, you don't feel afraid directly. You don't have a shot of anxiety. But if you the conditioned mind says if you drop the doubt, then you'll be in a panic. And on the contrary, if you can relax the doubt, which is paralyzing, as you say, and instead use the inner observer, use your ability to witness your own interior structure and go down into your body, and there, sure enough, inside, you'll find some place in your body where it feels stuck or contracted. And when you go into that place, simply relax a little bit into the contraction. And you get so involved in working the contraction and relaxing into that holding pattern in your body that your fear starts to go away. As soon as you pay attention inwardly to a contraction that holds an emotional state at bay, and start to relax in its own vocabulary, you'd question, now, how rigid is this? How soft is it? Does it have a color attached to it? And it may be that the contraction seems, you know, doesn't seem as if it's going to move. So then you move your attention away from the contraction to a place in your body where you feel energetically free, which might be your legs. It might be the front of your face. It might be anywhere in your body. And you just hang out where internally, without coming out again, you stick with the free place inside your body. And then you go back and investigate the contraction again. And you will see that it has shifted, either shifted its position in your body or shifted its intensity. So you work your attention using the inner observer. You use your attention to relax into the resistance in your body. And when that flattens out, you go to a place where there is no resistance in your body. Because both those places, the free place and the stuck place, coexist at the same time. You work the contraction in the body and no fear comes. Just progressive relaxation of the contraction that is holding the fear. As soon as you start thinking again, the fear might return. So it's a process. It's not that difficult to accomplish, where you're actually investigating the contraction against the panic. And by investigating and placing your attention there, you've removed your attention from, in your brain, you've removed your attention from the neurological tracks encoded in your brain that says, if I ever feel this panic, I'll be undone, just like I was when I was young. Instead, all you have is a kind of a stuck place in your body because this is now. That's not then. And you're caught in a recreation of then in the present moment. Did I make that clear?
It's very, very clear. Very clear. And the one thing I want to make sure that I'm clear about is what exactly do you mean by finding a place that's contracted in your body? I mean, I'm assuming that you mean, you know, like where I hold my tension or my stress, like,
yes,
like in my abdomen or in my stomach area.
Well, what I'm saying is that when you notice, the first task of the inner observer is to notice the thought pattern of recreated doubt. And you can
right.
do that, especially when you're alone. Here I go again. I'm thinking this pattern of, you know, negative thoughts. If you notice that, relax into your body and see where that's being supported. That negative thought pattern is being supported by a place in your body where there is a contraction against the life force. All you want to do is to get your life force back again, the way that it does when you're not doubting. When you're happy, all you're trying to do is to cooperate with the mechanics of how you hold tension in the body and relax into that just long enough to relax it a little bit. And you can get very engrossed
yeah.
in this whole self-healing method. Yeah.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. Will I get to a point where I can make decisions without flooding myself with doubt and sitting
well,
on
well, what
the
you're
bed.
Doing is creating an anti-doubt neurological pattern, to tell you the truth. That
oh,
if you,
well, good.
If you catch, well, all of this, you know, all of this internal work creates a new set of tracks, a new set of neurological patterns. Doubt is a neurological pattern. We don't have any problem with that because we know it runs us rather than it, you know, coming when it's useful. It runs us. But to actually relax at the time that you're having the doubt attack, so to speak, you relax into the place inside your body that is supporting the doubt attack. Now we're getting somewhere because the neurological track is interrupted. And instead you're bringing relaxation, which allows the life force to come through a little bit in that stuck place. And the result of that is a fusion of life force coming into a previously fixed pattern. It's important work, and yes, you can get to a place where you have no fear.
Beautiful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Can't wait to try that.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for your call. I want to ask you a few of the questions that people have typed in via computer, Helen.
Mm-hmm.
There are quite a few really great ones. I'm seeing perhaps we won't be able to get to all of them, but here's one I'd like to share. Ron in Boulder says that he has spent the last 3 years with a practice of resting for short moments in awareness as a way of recognizing the inseparability of thoughts, emotions, and sensations with awareness itself.
Mm.
Yet over time, he found that because the teaching didn't focus on all the psychological barriers to the process, something didn't move for him. He thinks perhaps this is a spiritual bypass. He's just interested to hear you comment on the need for both the awareness of the specifics of our psychological barriers and the need for that free awareness, that ability to rest in that recognition of awareness as awareness, the spiritual dimension, and then this notion of spiritual bypass.
Actually, I wouldn't use the word bypass in this case. I love it that he has a clear experience of resting in pure awareness. When you're resting, the life force is allowed to freely circulate in your body. There's very little impedance. When you start to recognize the psychological issues that come forward, present themselves when you're resting, it simply flattens out the practice so that you can't get a little deeper. And the fact that you know that, when it flattens, when it's working, when an issue is starting to surface, tells me that you have an extremely good inner observer, because these are not cognitive emotional knowings. You don't know cognitively that your resting in awareness has flattened out. You know it through your senses, which telegraphs to your inner awareness. You don't have to run it through the thinking machine. You know it directly. Now, it doesn't last very long, but it's very valuable that you can know without thought or emotion the flattening of the resting state and when the resting state is beginning to unfold and deepen. That's great. About the matter of the pure psychological issues coming up, I would suggest that you see inside yourself that you have a very simple map to follow. The Enneagram map is pretty articulate, simple to follow. It has a name for a thought pattern. So you're one of those nine thought patterns. And if you don't know your type yet, you should be busy trying to find it out, because it allows the inner observer to recognize the thought patterns more swiftly and closer to the arising point of those thoughts. So the inner observer would recognize the thought pattern that you have as it starts to arise. This would be a good thing, because you can relax or shift your state of consciousness right at the arising of the thought pattern. Let's say it's envy. I don't suppose that you are a four in the Enneagram or an envious type, but it's a good example. You could recognize the surfacing of envy as it begins to appear to the inner observer, and before it becomes florid and triggers that whole cascade of neurological condition patterns that put you into an envious position, and it's always been this way, and it will never change, and this is my fate, etc. But whatever type you are, if you could focus on the breathing and the resting state, and recognize as the pattern of thinking begins to arise, find what it is. You probably know something about your Enneagram type, because it makes it a whole lot easier to recognize if you know if it's envy or pride or avarice or any of those. And they're detailed in that first book pretty well. When the thought pattern comes, relax immediately. That's the easiest conditioned pattern internal to yourself that the inner observer can recognize. Relax the thoughts. If you have any kind of a resting awareness practice, they will dissolve pretty easily, particularly if they're known to you. Oh, here I go again. This is my thinking pattern. This is conditioned. This is a recreation. What you're after, all types are aiming at relaxing into the emotional habit, which is loaded with life force, loaded with life force, and the structures of the physical body that contract against the life force so that we don't have to know we have this passion. It doesn't mean that there's any terrible thing, you know, happening. It just means that the passion is starting to be revealed. And it will resist moving deeper into the unknown with your resting in awareness practice. Nothing wrong with resting in awareness. What you have told me is that there is something about an engagement of the emotional habit that rises as you begin to relax the thoughts. And that is fuel. That is convertible energy. It's presenting itself as a flattening out of the awareness practice. Well, just relax a little deeper right at the moment when awareness starts to drift, when the resting holding pattern starts to drift. Relax into what is causing that drift, which is simply blocked energetics in your body. To tell the truth, it's the rising of the passion, but it's really an encounter with the unknown. The unknown is in the present moment, and your resting practice has been sufficient to get you well into the present moment. When a pattern of emotion comes, just relax into the emotion, right through the emotion, because instinctively, we want to bail away from that emotion, even though intellectually we know there is no danger in arising emotion. It's no big deal. It happens 1,000 times a day. But we're not aware of that. So if you relax right through the rising of the emotional reaction to the unknown, you're going to get somewhere. But don't think that there is any real difficulty in your practice. That seems to be working. What isn't working so much is that the practice is now in a kind of a relationship with an emotional passion that resists going into the unknown. The technique would be to relax into that rising emotion instead of going away from it. The whole technique of meditation is to go through whatever arises, down into a deeper place of emptiness. Good question, actually.
Yes, I thought so. Thank you. That was very, very rich, Helen. Well, there are a slew of questions here, and I'm actually feeling moved to try to summarize a lot of what's come in, and in a way, I even have a piece to add to it, which is people are asking questions along the lines of, gosh, if I relax into it, and I do that, and I resolve that, like with in the process with the woman who you interacted with live. If she were to become free of fear, would she no longer be a six?
No way, no way. The type structure is very successful on the horizontal plane of living. We don't want to give up the orientation of questioning mind. It's gotten her, you know, through life so far. We don't want to give up the orientation of recognizing danger when it actually occurs. What's wrong with that? The orientation of the type never goes away. For example, the pride type on the Enneagram is very interested in serving other people's needs for a whole psychological agenda that I won't go into. But there's nothing wrong with the orientation of helping other people. What's wrong with the orientation of the type? You know, my orientation is problem-solving, and so was the first caller in. And there's nothing wrong with the problem-solving mind. We're extremely useful given, you know, certain situations in life. We're very useful people. We are not living that way. We think about things in that way. The orientation's fine. All you want to do is drop the suffering. That definitely has to go. There's nothing wrong with having a type structure. It's not like all the types become little Buddhas, you know, without a type. It's nonsense. You still have the orientation, the constructive orientation of your thought, of your type. I'm thoughtful about things, you know. I like it that way. You know, I take pleasure in it. There's nothing wrong with being a six. But I just don't want to have doubtful thoughts about other people when they're absolutely not reasonable. That's what has to go.
But there is something that I've noticed in my admittedly less thorough study of the Enneagram that I see, which is as I deepen into it, I notice aspects of the patterns of all the types, and I feel less embedded in my typological pattern.
Now, I think there is some kind of shifting, isn't there? You know, Terry, I have to challenge. I think that you're embedded. I think I'm embedded. I think the caller in is embedded. We have a type structure. What I'm trying to say is they're constructive, and they're very useful in the horizontal plane of daily living. But the suffering part of it, the passion of the heart, envy, pride, avarice, fear, gluttony, those passions are loaded with life force, and they are totally conditioned from childhood experience to move us in a predictable direction. Now, that's what has to go. But the life force itself that is fueling that condition, if you relax the conditioning, you got the life force back. That's what we're after. Life force has to have a house, and the house is the structure. We just don't want the house to be full of suffering.
So you wouldn't... Do you notice that people, as they grow, notice all the different patterns of the Enneagram at deeper and deeper levels?
No, I would say occasionally. The conversion from what is called the passion of the heart or the vice. Now, vice I know is loaded with spiritual language baggage, but the vice is it squeezes. It's a contraction in the physical body. When I get scared, I contract in my physical body. But I know that this is happening because of my experience with meditation. I know that if I let the contraction relax just slightly and go immediately to the contraction and relax the contraction, then I have no fear. Now, what are you going to call the absence of fear where previously you were afraid? You have to give it a word in common English usage, and that word in the Enneagram is called the virtue of courage. And what it means is that the virtue, or the life force from the root Latin vers, energy, the life force begins to flow where previously it was not allowed to flow. We were so afraid that a recreation, something triggered us, and we're so afraid that that trigger means that we're in instinctual jeopardy, and this whole cascade coming out straight out of the reptilian brain is informing us that we're under siege according to our type. It's nonsense. That's what we want to get rid of. And we will. Through this interface of recognizing, inner observer recognizing, when you begin to go on automatic according to your type, the thought pattern is the first indication, relatively easy to recognize by the inner observer. Relaxing the thoughts, you come to what is driving the thoughts, that's a little dicier, and you relax into the pattern as it begins to arise, the emotional contraction as it begins to arise, that's freedom. But it doesn't mean that I go anywhere except through the conduit of my type structure. Otherwise, it's a fantasy. It's premature. It's an idea rather than a living reality of I can go through my resistance to reality as it actually unfolds. Every type can do that. And then we all come out with something like, wow, previously I was contracted in one of nine ways. Now I'm not. And life goes up a notch energetically. From that higher stance, the view is different. The perceptual view of reality as it's actually unfolding changes. So there's not much to be afraid of. unless it's an actual thing that everybody should be afraid of. The view changes. But it doesn't mean that I have used the transformative structure of my own type as another type might experience it. I'm not deprived in many ways of the love of other people. I'm not love deprived. So the transit from unlove, lack of love, into free-flowing life force, from that perspective of feeling damaged from lack of love, and all of a sudden your view changes through your own energetic conversion, deliberate through meditation, all of a sudden you live in a loving reality. You can see the reality of life as it actually unfolds. Sometimes it has negative passages. Sometimes it has positive. But you're playing with a full deck. You can see the reality of the emerging emotion in yourself. I don't have the structure, Terry, you know, of a 7, for example, or of a 5. I'm not contracted in the same places of life as they are. I'm not going to ever turn into another type. But at the higher level of consciousness, the holy ideas, we pretty much can participate in that realm of qualities of being that were previously barred by the constriction of our type.
Mm. And in that way, that gives us more access, perhaps, to notice and sympathetically resonate or to put ourselves maybe in the shoes of other types or feel.
Boy, does the world look different from the view screen of another type of person.
Yeah.
And until you really step into their shoes and actually experience the racing futuristic mind of the 7, I don't work like that, Terry.
Mm.
Until you step into the shoes of a detached type 5, where some little emotion gets triggered and you literally unhook, leave yourself, and can observe yourself, watch yourself, having a conversation with somebody else. So you have 3 parties in the conversation. You've got yourself, the person you're talking to, and this silent witness up there frozen in time. I don't work like that. I don't unhook into a separate stance of attention under pressure like a 5 does. So if I'm starting to work with myself, I have to start with where I am, you know, which is fearful, doubtful thinking, and relax that, and then I become an undoubtful thinking person, and then I relax the emotion driving it, and I become an unafraid person. The structures are very discreet, one from another. And you know, maybe it's my over-precision of mind, but I don't like going into the future of how it could be. And I don't like going much into the assumption that everybody does the same rite of passage. They do, but their structure is so different that it seems very different from the inside.
Yeah. I get it.
This is what psychologists do. They differentiate between different types of people. And your interventions are not going to work if you've got the wrong type.
Helen, I just want to go on and on. I'm very frustrated that we're out of time now because there's so many rich places to take this. You've really opened it up. And yet I think it's resolved enough. Since our time is up, we should move on. Thank you so much. This has been a very rich conversation. And I want to tell everybody what's up next week and give us all a chance to say goodbye. Here are a few reminders. If you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it, directing them to beyondawakeningseries.com. And if you're interested in learning more about Helen Palmer, you can find out that information through her books EnneagramWorldwide.com for her teaching schedules and Enneagram.com for distance learning offerings. You can also go to TerryPatton.com and read my blog entries, sign up for my personal mailing list and newsletter. TerryPattonCourse.com is where you can find the course I was telling you about earlier. 3 weeks from today at our regular time, 10 a.m., on Sunday, April 7th, I'm really delighted that I'll be joined in conversation by Stanislav Grof, the world-famous consciousness explorer, pioneer of transpersonal psychology, early LSD researcher, founder of holotropic breathwork, in a program entitled Waking Up at Sunset. So thank you again, Helen. This has been so rich. Thank you, everybody. Let's open up our lines. And for those of us who called in, let's say goodbye.
Hey,
goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Bye, Tim.
Oh, one of them.
Goodbye.
Thank you.
Thank you.